This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A massive heat wave stretches across Asia from the Middle East to Indochina. India's heat waves are no ordinary phenomenon. This spring, some Indian temperatures soared to nearly 50 degrees C around the country, over 120 degrees Fahrenheit. March was the hottest in 122 years, and the heat wave hit much earlier than usual. How will Indian cities prepare to survive climate change? What is the future for 1.5 billion people there? We have contacted an internationally connected climate scientist. Dr. Manal Pathak is associate professor at Ahmedabad University in a city of more than 8 million people. In addition to her contributions to IPCC reports, Manal Pathak specializes in urban adaptation. From Ahmedabad, Manal Pathak, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us about your weather lately. How are people in your city coping?
It's really the middle of summer. I don't think we are doing any better than what we were last year. Summers are getting progressively worse. And while we have a few climate initiatives now, I don't think they're enough. And if a lot of people may be aware that India is also going through a major election, our national elections are underway in most of the country. And people are standing in long queues to vote. It was scheduled in my city yesterday, so I went to vote and I tried to get in early, so 8 a.m. But it was extremely uncomfortable. It was hot. I didn't check the temperature, but it might be around maybe between 36 and 38 degrees Celsius, and it was a bit humid. And these were like held in cramped voting centers. There were a lot of people there. I saw a lot of senior citizens there, and heat with humidity, and we were all perspiring, and I just didn't feel very well at the end of the day. And you're talking to someone who is already a privileged citizen, right? So I have an air-conditioned home, an air-conditioned office. I also own a car. But there's a whole lot of people in the country, in cities, who lack basic facilities. Some of them don't even have properly ventilated housing. They don't have fans to cool themselves. And many of these people actually have to go work outdoors. So I would say it doesn't look good in summary. It's quite depressing, actually, to be honest.
And with oppressive heat becoming more common across India, has climate change emerged as an election issue?
So, well, the good news is that climate is a lot more in conversation, in mainstream conversation than it used to be. For example, climate or environment didn't really feature prominently in past election manifestos. If you look at elections a decade ago, there was no conversation around environment. And now people do realize that this is a reality. It's affecting them. And a lot of people care and are concerned. So it's appeared if you look at the major parties, then you can see climate appearing in the manifestos now, which is great. So there's promises around energy independence. There's promises around scaling up renewable energy. Even technology is mentioned, and including rooftop solar and funding for climate initiatives. But I don't think it's like a make or break thing. I don't think people are voting for these parties on the basis of their climate promises, partly because there is still limited awareness. So there is awareness that climate change is happening, but there isn't really, I don't think people are making that explicit connection between actions and what we are facing. So it's still kind of disconnected. And I wouldn't say this is true for India. I think it's true for a lot of the world, where people see that they're suffering, but they somehow, when it comes to taking action, we kind of disengage from that conversation. And the other thing, coming back to your question, was that yes, it's in the manifestos, but then it's sort of a bit vague still. So there are like big promises, but not really specificity regarding targets, for example, or when certain initiatives will be implemented. So on paper, these look good, but I would have liked to see a little more.
Well, all of that could be said for Canada, the United States, and many countries, as you say. So, broadly, what is the Modi government's position on climate change?
So on the one hand, I would appreciate the government for taking really ambitious actions on renewable energy, for example. That's like really a big success story, right? We've outpaced our solar targets. We're doing well on wind and other renewable energy initiatives. And there's a very interesting program. I don't know if you're aware. It's called Mission Life. And it was announced by the Prime Minister a couple of years ago at the climate meeting, COP. And this is about making lifestyle changes for sustainability. And I thought it was a great idea, although we still have to, like I said, put some teeth on it. So what does it mean? And how do we tell people to make these lifestyle changes? So there has been initiatives by the Indian government on taking action. But then on the other hand, I feel the pace is not enough, particularly if you look at where we need to be in terms of global mitigation ambition. India is a big country, and while the per capita emissions are quite low because we are so many people, India's decisions or the pace of it will make a big difference to global climate change, both in the near future, but definitely long-term ambition as well. So I feel we probably need to do more. But Modi's stand is very clear that historically India hasn't contributed as much as some of the Western countries, particularly US and EU. And therefore, the onus is really on these countries to provide the finance and to take bolder steps, because a lot of India still needs room to develop and grow. So I think on one hand, the government says, yes, we need to do more on renewable energy. But on the other hand, the government feels that we're doing enough. And any more ambition will lead to like much higher costs, and to some extent might also compromise near-term development.
I heard India may have reduced heat deaths during extreme events. Following mass heat deaths just a few years ago, governments implemented emergency planning for heat waves. Is that true? And what actions have been taken?
That is true, and that's another one of our successful programs. So I think, and I'm not very sure, but it did start in my city of Ahmedabad, where Ahmedabad's heat action plan was among South Asia's first for a city. And it was a really great plan because it brought together government, the private sector, and US's NRDC, I think it's called National Resources Defense Council. I believe they're an energy organization as well. So anyway, these stakeholders came together and produced this heat action plan, which was mostly focused on early warning. So telling people when there is a heat wave to take shelter, not to step out during during the peak hours in the afternoon. It had initiatives like building capacity of the health workers. And then that was such a big success, in the sense that the plan rolled out almost immediately in that year. In a couple of years, we had evidence that this had actually reduced heat deaths. More people were availing of these emergency services, and you could see posters around the city, with these animations and stuff, telling people to cover themselves and take shelter, etc. And then this was, because of its success, it was replicated in a number of states and cities. So I think there are at least 23 states now in India which have these heat action plans. And while some of them are just focusing on early warning, some others are a little more ambitious, and they talk about long-term measures also, including tree planting and reducing the overall heat in the city. So that's the good side of the story. The sort of slightly more problematic side is that we need to do a lot more. We need to raise ambition, because these heat action plans are still standalone. They're not really mainstreamed into city development plans. So on the one hand, we're trying to tell people, okay, protect yourselves from heat. The city governments are doing what they can. But then on the other hand, the urban development is going on in business as usual. So we still have all these concrete buildings and a lot of concrete on the roads and sidewalks. And so that's also increasing the heat in cities. So I feel like we really need to sort of mainstream heat into our development process, which is not yet happening.
Is it possible to know how many people in rural India are dying due to extreme heat?
I don't think it's very easy to know that. But one of the reasons is data issues, that that we really need to record deaths more systematically. And in India, healthcare is divided between public and private healthcare systems. And therefore, we don't have a very solid database on health, particularly on mortality and the causes for mortality. So there are some studies which have attributed, for example, daytime temperatures with deaths on that day. But I think the short answer to your question is no. It's really difficult at the moment.
Do Indian media report the role of climate change and emissions in stories during these heat waves?
The Indian media reports heat, the changing climate, the impacts, the future impacts, but I don't think we are relating it to emissions that explicitly in the media, which is a problem. We're not doing that. But I wanted to go back to your previous question on rural India, and I wanted to say that, not that I have data, but I feel rural India is still in many ways more sustainable. So they have lower density, lower concrete, and more shaded areas, and people still live a traditional way of life. And I feel like urban India, particularly all these migrant workers, they come to these cities to work, and they are a lot more exposed because they're working in the heat. Like all these construction workers, they are outdoors like 8 hours, 10 hours a day. And many of them may be rushed to emergency wards in hospitals. And really, we don't have a good idea of how many of them are exposed.
This year, you co-authored a helpful paper on a just transition away from coal. As coal declines, some places will suffer more than others. But no transition away from coal is really happening in India, as far as I can tell. In August 2023, at a lecture, the Deputy Director General of the Ministry of Coal, Santosh Agarwal, said, "As far as India is concerned, transition away from coal is not happening in the near future," end quote. The government intends actually to increase coal burning in the near term. Manal, how do you see this conflict between climate needs and economic planning?
So that's a very complex question. Let me try to unpack it a bit. So let me give you two or three lines of argument for and against. So, I mean, one of the arguments that the Indian government is making, like I mentioned before on this call, is that if you look at contributions of countries, then India probably contributed like 4% to historical emissions. So if you look at emissions between 1850 to let's say 2019, India's contribution was 4% compared to like 20%, I think, for the United States, or around that number for EU and China. India's argument is that the bulk of the responsibility for action rests with the countries which have contributed more and have a higher means to act. Having said that, I know that the coal jobs in India are not great jobs. If you go to the mines and ask the coal worker, "Do you want your son to do this?" He would, I'm sure, say no. He has actually in one of the interviews we did. So we do want to move away from coal, but you see, it's very difficult because coal brings a lot of revenue to state governments and district governments. So there's the coal cess, there's a mineral fund, and there's a bunch of taxes that coal companies pay. And coal also drives a lot of freight in the country. So it also gives a revenue to Indian railways. So if you move away immediately from coal, then you lose a lot of revenue. And that's really not very easy. The good news is that renewables are really becoming cost effective. You know that globally the price of solar has dropped by 85%. I mean, whether the government says it or not, we're already moving away from coal. The investments in new coal plants is difficult, but then how else do you meet the power demand for such a large country? So the challenge really is that we want energy security, and we really don't have, until solar and wind and battery storage become so cost effective that we can have a stable grid away from coal. But in the near term, I don't see how we can just stop coal in the next decade or so. But I'm still hopeful. As a scientist, I'm looking at development in technology, at energy trading, and if dispatchable energy becomes a reality, then I don't think we need to depend on the coal plants that much. And just one last point on your question is that a lot of other countries, for example, the UK, was also reopening coal plants. And I know the U.S. is investing heavily in shale gas. So there's also all these other things in the world. So climate is about international cooperation. So it's not about one country or the other. It's about all countries raising ambition at the same time and going beyond national interest to say, yes, we will probably lose jobs in the short run, but we're going to have to all work together to see how we can help those communities and take action. And so I feel like the whataboutism is really coming in the way of collective climate action. And every time I go to these international climate meetings, I hear, what about China? What about India? And then if I am in the domestic, I don't know, setting, I hear, what about the US? And then that's really not the way we are going to be able to get where we want to go.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Aminal Pathak for the University of Ahmedabad, India.
All right, you also co-authored the 2022 paper, Mitigation Co-Benefits of Climate Change Adaptation, a case study analysis of 8 cities. And one of the cities studied was Surat, India, with over 5 million people. Tell us about Surat and climate planning.
So Surat is among the early movers. It's an industrial city and also growing very fast. But the Rockefeller Foundation funded like 100 Indian cities, 100 global cities a decade ago, and Surat was selected among those 3 Indian cities. So they had initial support to build a resilience strategy for Surat. And I think that plan looks really good. And Surat therefore was able to start early on, and they have taken measures, for example, to reduce flooding. So Surat has this river running through, and they have a flood warning system. So it's quite an interesting case study. And I feel like if many of these cities get the support, they like Surat, the level of ambition would be higher. So I don't know how familiar the listeners are with the Indian system, but like cities don't have resources really or capacity. So it's very, very different. If you go to a small and medium-sized city, like say a little smaller than Surat, there would probably be a couple of people just running the show, and they have to manage the solid waste and the water and just provide housing for all the new people who come in and roads and all the day-to-day development necessities or services. And therefore, climate doesn't often assume a priority. So if you want cities to take actions, then you have to enable them with finance, with capacity, you know. I mean, I take all these fancy IPCC charts. Sometimes I get like responses from policymakers saying, I'm sorry, I don't understand. Explain this graph to me. And this may be true for a lot of other cities around the world. So it's not just India, but you look at Latin American cities or African cities, for example. There's really a capacity issue there. We need a lot more technical people in these cities to be able to understand what actions are relevant for their cities, what might work, and what kind of support they need, and often even how to leverage that support. So if I'm a city, let's say of 1 million, which is, by the way, small in the Indian context, I don't know where to get the money from. I don't know. There's all this climate finance talk that I'm hearing internationally, but I really don't have a way to get it to my city. And if I do, then I don't know which action should I take that will give me the highest return on climate or development. So I paper really was about how do you take development as a framing for climate? Are there actions, for example, that improve people's mobility and that can also reduce emissions? Because for a lot of developing countries, that development framing will be a really good way to accelerate climate action. So you tell a policymaker, you do this, and a lot of people will have health benefits. Take this, reduce concrete, and you'll reduce heat-related impacts. And they like that. And then if that also reduces emissions, then it's a great win-win. So we're trying to find more of these solutions that improve well-being, that generate jobs, but also address climate. Whereas in the West, I think climate becomes a central framing. So you want to take climate action and you want to do other things. But I think for our context to get multiple wins is really, really a priority.
Right. Well, surprising heat waves all over the world show us that every city needs an emergency heat plan. Ahmedabad is rated as one of the hottest in Asia, with uncomfortable heat on 331 of 365 days. Talk to us about ideas for short-term resilience. What can cities, including in India, do?
I think first thing that cities need to do is to identify who is more vulnerable. It's not a general heat action plan, but really to look at people who are in these most precarious professions. So if I just walk outside my door downstairs in the street, I'm going to see vegetable vendors, fruit vendors, people who manually pull these freight carts. And there's I can almost think of 24 occupations where people spend more than 8 hours outdoors. And it's not just their own personal health, but it's also what they're selling. So it's an economic loss as well because of heat. And I think the top priority has to be to protect them, to identify them, first of all, and to find ways to protect them, to give them shelter. But also, how do you improve, for example, finance that goes to them? Maybe what they're losing as daily wage. Like if these people, they earn on a day-to-day basis. So if I miss 2 days of work, it's really a big loss because I support my family and I just cannot afford, I don't have any savings. And so these are the people, I think the immediate short-term priority should be addressing the vulnerability of the populations. But the slightly medium term would be, I would say, look at housing, because I feel like among all the initiatives, housing is really key. So many of these people, they live in slums or like one room. I wouldn't even call them houses. They're like really just shelters, basic shelters. And many of these have metal roofs. And these houses really heat up because the roof heats up in the afternoons. And we did a study a few years ago and we measured temperatures inside these houses and outside these houses. And we found in some cases that the temperature inside the house was higher than the outdoor temperature, which is really strange because it's a matter of concern, because the outdoor temperature sometimes is 45 and the indoor temperature we measured was 48 degrees Celsius. That's almost like an inhuman way of survival. So are they surviving? Yes. Is there well-being? No. So I think we really need to fix informal housing and to just give people more dignity with housing and infrastructure. It's not about people like me, but it's about a section in the society who's really facing the worst of climate change and almost having contributed nothing to it. Like they almost have zero emissions. They don't even meet like basic decent standards of energy consumption. For example, they don't have electricity. They don't have as many appliances. They don't own motorized vehicles. So even by a global average, their consumption or contribution to climate change is a fraction of the global average. So I feel like we're really not doing justice to these large populations around the world.
And frankly, I'm not sure long-term adaptation is possible if the world warms 3 degrees C or more. Cities of concrete and asphalt are like heat sinks. During heat waves, people cannot survive for long without electricity, although some manage to. What if the world warms faster than we can act, especially in democracies with slow bureaucracies?
I think all countries have slow bureaucracies, but that's just my own take on it. I definitely think that the future is concerning. One, because there's an uncertainty around future climate. We are assuming that climate changes in response to emissions as we have seen, but we know that that may not be true. And what if, like you say, that we release X amount of emissions and we expect, let's say, the global temperature to increase by some measure, but it's actually much more than that. So we're looking at huge biodiversity loss. We're seeing a world that we have not experienced in the near history. And we really don't know enough about that world. Scientifically, we call it an overshoot world. So what if you come back to 1.5, but you overshoot a threshold in the interim? And what does that overshoot mean? What does the world look like in that extreme scenario? There are limits to adaptation. It's not going to be easy, and therefore we must just start now. The good news is that there's a lot of cities are also taking action. There is more increase in green cover in many parts of the world. Even in the developing countries, I'm seeing cities wanting to take action on enhancing urban forests as much as possible, right? But there is now greater awareness, and I mean, if I had to end with some hope, then I would say that let's not get buoyed down by how depressing the future looks, because that may just discourage people from taking action. And if we did this interview, maybe say 5 years from now, my responses would be very different. I think we would have definitely run out of time and carbon budget. But we are doing this now, and scientifically and practically, it is still possible to avoid the worst impacts of climate change. And like, I would just urge all the people listening to this show that really let's put our day-to-day matters aside and really think how, because we are at a unique point in history. We will be looked at far into the history too as a population that just failed to take action and that just gave our future generation a really bad world. And it is up to us to go beyond our individual interests and really see that there are people in the world who are far worse off than what we are. And we should really care. I'm sure a lot of people care, but sometimes we just forget because maybe I have a deadline at work or my daughter has exams at school or, you know, people have these pressing matters that they think are pressing on a day-to-day level. But I can tell you, looking at that future climate graphs and maps, that we really, really do need to ramp up action at every level.
Men still outnumber women in climate science, even though polls find women are more likely than men to believe in climate science. Manal, you co-authored a 2022 study called Survey of Gender Bias in the IPCC. What are the risks of underrepresenting and really not listening to women about climate change?
Yeah, we're not really listening to women, generally speaking, not just around climate. If you look at representation of women in parliaments, in leadership positions, in companies, in governments, it's not balanced. We don't have a lot of literature on it, but we do have enough literature to say that women make better choices with regard to climate. They consume lower energy, partly because in many parts of the world, women don't even travel because they don't have access to mobility, but generally speaking, because in many cases, women also influence household decisions about what food is brought in the house or how the house runs. And therefore, women have a better understanding of consumption, and involving more women in climate decisions is likely to lead to better outcomes. And it has been shown that in societies where women have a higher voice in the formation of the government, it leads to more balanced decisions. We do need to have more women. We need to have not just for representation, but also their voices heard and their opinions that are taken into consideration in policy making. So we have a long way to go, but we should raise this very important questions.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. From Ahmedabad University, we've been speaking with Associate Professor Manal Pathak. Find links to her recent papers and this conversation in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Manal, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Alex, for having me.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
What was once predicted only by models is now playing out in real time across the world. Extreme rains flood desert cities. Heat records are smashed daily on multiple continents. Professor Wolfgang Kramer has documented it all since the early 1990s. This IPCC author, with over 150 peer-reviewed papers, joins other scientists and academics calling on the public to become climate advocates and activists. Wolfgang was a longtime scientist at the Potsdam Institute. He is now director of research and professor of global ecology at the Mediterranean Institute for Marine and Terrestrial Biodiversity and Ecology, and that's located at Aix Marseille Université. From France, Wolfgang Kramer, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello.
Well, as climate destabilizes the life support systems, it's pretty frightening. Are some places becoming too dangerous to live in?
That may be the case, that some places become too dangerous to live in, but that will not be the same for each and everyone in the population. So when we talk about dangerous places, then we mostly look at the fact that the poor people are the ones that are worse hit by climate warming, while richer people are able still to protect themselves with air conditioning and other systems. And the Mediterranean is an excellent case to illustrate that.
Several of our recent guests worry loss of habitability will lead to mass migration towards safer places like Europe, North America, or Australia. But in a recent presentation at a French university, you said there are no climate migrants. Why?
Yeah, there are no climate migrants in the strict sense because empirical research has shown that if you actually talk to migrants, and there I'm mostly talking about migrants who migrate because of suffering, because of difficulties in their lives, and most of the time these people will not mention climate change as the primary cause for their distress. They will say that we no longer can afford to live where we are, we can no longer produce in agriculture, we are at risk from conflict, from instable society, and so many of these people suffer from multiple causes, and calling them climate migrants is a way to basically take away all the other factors that make life hard for people in countries that are in distress. So climate migrants, there's a climate part in the migration decision somewhere, but it's rarely the dominant decision.
At the end of April 2024, extreme heat forced school closures for 33 million people in Bangladesh. Within decades, the rising seas, extreme high storm surges, and saltwater intrusion will make large parts of that country uninhabitable, and that's with over 170 million people, and their borders are more or less closed. If they cannot migrate, what happens to them?
Well, the situation in countries like Bangladesh is complex. But it has also been shown that in these countries, people are actually more able, more capable to adapt to changes such as sea level rise. And, for example, people in the Mediterranean are. Why would that be? That may first sound surprising, but the fact is that most people living along the coastline of Bangladesh live in very simple and poor housing that can be actually placed higher up in places further north in the country to a certain extent much easier than is the case for expensive holiday condos on the Mediterranean coast or for ship marinas and for other heavy investments that were made by rich people in the Mediterranean. In Bangladesh, I do not at all want to reduce the dramatic consequences that climate change and sea level rise have for the country, and they need to be dealt with, and countries like Bangladesh need substantial help, but they can be helped, and it is possible to protect populations in the country by giving them technical support for establishing livelihoods elsewhere. It is unlikely or it's inconceivable that just the whole population of a large country such as Bangladesh will start to move. That is not an option that they have and that they will consider once they are given other opportunities to maintain their livelihoods in the country.
In earlier years, you studied forests and biology. How did that work carry forward for you into research and publishing about climate change?
Well, this was in the 1980s, when not only I was a young scientist and I did my PhD, but also computers arrived on the scene, and it became possible to use mathematical formulations of processes such as growth and mortality and competition in forests to describe them mathematically and to project what future climate change would bring to them. And this was a very exciting field of research in the 1990s. where a large community that I belong to developed those computer models that are now a standard feature in the large-scale Earth system models that the IPCC uses to predict the future of the planet. For me, it was quite natural when I discovered that there was such a broad public interest in our calculations that I would spend actually more time making sure that the outcomes from computer models were communicated appropriately to people and were also seen in the social and economic context than myself staying in the modeling community where I was initially. So it was a natural process from the production of scientific results to maybe more communication and more synthesis in the context of telling the public and aiding policymakers to hopefully take meaningful decisions in the face of the risks that are caused by climate change.
Wolfgang, you were a longtime scientist at the Potsdam Institute. Recently, that institute and its director, Stefan Ramsdorf, issued a broad public warning about climate tipping points. On Radio EcoShock, a series of PIC scientists, including Levka Caesar, said the big North Atlantic ocean current that warms northern Europe could weaken or eventually fail. What do you think?
First of all, I have to recognize that some people have worked on this topic very hard, and in the case of Stefan Ramsdorf, for more than 30 years. So I have a tendency to look at their papers as an inspiration rather than criticizing them, because I'm not a physical oceanographer. So what Professor Ramsdorf is showing very clearly is that the changes in the North Atlantic circulation with the associated climate change have occurred on several occasions in the geological past. So it is not an unknown phenomenon that sort of has never been heard of. But he also has shown with his colleagues and with a large network of international colleagues that there are now growing and ever stronger indications that we might actually be rather near such a point again, where the production of deep water in the North Atlantic essentially would stop, and therefore a much reduced flow of warm water from the south, warm surface water from the south, not just from the Gulf of Mexico, but from the southern Atlantic, that flow would stop or be greatly reduced. This is not something that is very easy to model, and therefore there are some other experts who say they find this rather unlikely. But I believe that this accumulated evidence that not only Stefan Ramsdorf but also others have delivered over the years makes this process likely to occur. It can still not be predicted with precision. But as he points out, the major issue for humanity with this is that we cannot actually afford to make mistakes there. In other words, if we were predicting the shutdown of the Atlantic circulation and it didn't happen, okay, that would be not such a big problem. But if we said, oh, we don't know, we cannot really predict it, so let's assume it will never happen, that would be a very dangerous position. It would be similar to boarding an airplane and not really knowing whether the airplane will land, or maybe someone says, okay, nine of the 10 last airplanes that have departed from this airport have successfully reached their destination. And you would say, well, one out of 10 hasn't reached it? That is not good enough for me. So all in all, what this community argues for, and it's been corroborated also by studies in the Netherlands and elsewhere, is that we cannot simply run that risk of shutdown of the North Atlantic circulation. We must stop global warming now, and that can only be done by reducing greenhouse gas emissions at a much higher rate than we have done so far.
You specialize in the environment of the Mediterranean. Please tell us about climate-driven impacts and extreme weather over the past year in that region that have struck you.
Yeah, first of all, as your question implies, there's a difference between the long-term trend, which is warming virtually everywhere on the planet, and the incidence of extreme events such as heat waves and storms and other events. They go together, but they are independent independent processes. And first of all, we have to recognize that the Mediterranean basin warms much faster than the global average. The global average, as you know, we are at 1.2 degrees above the pre-industrial. The Mediterranean basin is somewhere between 1.7 and 1.8. So it's already on average warmer than it has been, than the rest of the planet has warmed. But this hits an area where we already have pretty high temperatures in summer and pretty dry conditions in summer. And so what happens with this additional warming is several things. First of all, that the heat waves, which are not unknown, people in the Mediterranean are familiar with heat waves, but these heat waves become longer and more intensive and therefore more deadly for those people who cannot protect themselves against them. And also because evaporation from the soil is increasing during these due to these high temperatures, there is more drought and significantly less water available for agricultural systems, but also for human use. And just to mention one example, the area of the eastern Pyrenees, basically Catalonia and the big city of Barcelona, has completely run out of water to the extent that they are now importing water by ship and potentially by a pipeline from the southeastern France, where the rivers from the Alps still supply sufficient water. So these are big-scale adaptation measures that are becoming necessary in order to deal with a water crisis. I've already mentioned the difficulties with heat waves that make it particularly hard for people with low income to continue to live, to not be affected by dehydration and by subsequent health problems. That is a problem particularly in the eastern Mediterranean, which comes on top of the war in Palestine and in Israel and makes conditions even harder for people that are in an extremely situation from the onset. With this, I have not mentioned one factor that is also particularly dramatic in the Mediterranean, and that is sea level rise. We've already talked about Bangladesh and sea level rise, but in the Mediterranean, the situation is particular because Mediterranean coastal ecosystems and also Mediterranean infrastructure, such as ports and cities and even heritage sites such as Venice and others, are built very close to mean water level. And why is that? That is because there's no tidal movement in the Mediterranean, or hardly any. There's some in the northern Adriatic, but for the rest of the Mediterranean, there's no tidal movement, so water levels are in general very stable. But if they continue to rise worldwide, they will also continue to rise in the Mediterranean. We are now well above 5 millimeters per year in sea level rise worldwide. And this in a situation where both ecosystems and human infrastructure are adapted to a very precise water level, and sometimes have been so for thousands of years, this causes problems that are very hard to deal with. And as you may have heard, the city of Venice has now built a sort of unfoldable sea wall that can be lifted out of the water when sea level runs very high. That has been a multi-billion-dollar project that has cost a lot of money and causes ecological repercussions in the Venice Lagoon. This system will be will no longer be useful at the end of the century when sea level rises continues at current rates, because sea level is so high that the design range of that system will be exceeded.
And I think the same is true about the Thames River barrier in the UK. It's just not going to be high enough. They'll have to build it higher or do something else. We began by talking about habitability. How do you define that? And what parts of the world can you point to that may be moving outside the human ecological niche?
Yeah, habitability is a term that I think is very useful to describe a number of things in combination with each other. The first is, of course, the physical possibility for human life, or for that sake, for life of any other species, to even occur. I mean, there are physiological limits. We cannot live above certain temperatures. We cannot live completely without water. We cannot live underwater. We can map principle on the map areas where life for the human species without protection is not possible. And such areas exist already today. They exist at the center of major deserts where there's essentially life possible only in specific places like oases or other, with other forms of protection, or in the very high mountains or in the middle of Greenland. So it is not so that currently any square meter of this planet is habitable. And it's also clear that with warming, the areas where the strict physiological constraints for human life are not given, or the conditions are not given, that those areas may increase. But for human civilization as we know it today, this is a only partially useful concept, because in reality, as we all know, we protect ourselves by building houses, by having air conditioning, by having heating systems, by protecting us against the rain, by irrigating our agricultural fields. So there is, in the term of habitability, there is a notion of economy and also of technical solutions. And what we notice now, as we start to study this a little more closely, is that habitability does decline for people on the planet, and also for many other species. And in part, it declines because of warming in the hottest areas, for example, in the driest areas, in the Sahara and the Sahel zone, in central Australia, in other areas. But more importantly, habitability declines because of social conditions. They decline because people are not, because of poor economy or because of wars or because of conflict or because of other phenomena, they are not able to protect themselves against climate anymore or against difficult conditions. And this must be seen in context, and research is now starting to sort this out a little bit more structured, and to then be able to answer the question that you're raising. If we talk about the Mediterranean basin, then yes, sea level rise will reduce the areas where people can live, for example, in the Nile Delta. Yes, heat waves will be more dramatic and more severe in the south of Spain and in the whole eastern part of the basin, and thereby make life difficult for both farmers and also for other people. But most of all, the lack of capacity to protect people against difficulties of climate is increasing because of the war, because of the general economic instability, and these things come together and reduce habitability for a lot of people.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Professor Wolfgang Kramer from the Mediterranean Institute for Biodiversity and Ecology in France. We're talking about big picture survival, climate, and beyond. Wolfgang Kramer, for years you contributed to scientific reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. What is the relationship between the IPCC and those annual climate meetings known as the Conference of the Parties?
Yeah, let me explain that briefly. I mean, as you know, in 1992 in Rio de Janeiro, the world came together and signed a number of conventions, which are essentially legal documents declaring certain goals for humanity, and one of them is the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which in its text stipulates a number of things, one of them being that countries should work together and do everything they can to avoid dangerous climate change. That's what Article 2 in that convention says. And what it also says, like many other UN conventions, is that every year country representatives should come together and look at the state of affairs with regard to the objectives of the convention. In other words, have we done enough in order to avoid dangerous climate change? That is what is called the Conference of the parties being the members of the countries who have signed the convention. So every year since 1992, there's a COP, a Conference of the Parties, and the representatives of all governments come together and discuss. what they need to do in order to, or what they need to have in order to take decisions and to redesign their policies at that stage is scientific information. And for that, for providing that, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climatic Change, the IPCC, was already founded a little before the 1992, and it was in 1988. But the IPCC has a mandate from governments to produce these reports, which then governments will use for a number of purposes, including the discussions at the COPs on how to strengthen efforts for protecting the world against the consequences of climate change. So the IPCC reports are published every 6 or 7 years. We are now entering the 7th cycle. They are written by scientists, but they are called upon by governments, and governments will carefully look at them and read them and ask a lot of questions in the final approval session. And at the end of that session, there is a magic moment, if you will, where governments conclude that now we have taken notice of this report and we all agree that that report represents the best state of our knowledge. This is important for the COPs, because the same government can then not logically go to the Conference of the Parties and say, oh, we don't believe this scientific report that we've seen, because actually they have just approved it. Perhaps the best way to describe the connection between the climate change convention process and the development of the IPCC reports.
Well, part of the reason I ask is that many people are becoming disillusioned with the COP process after 30 years of meetings. Greenhouse gas emissions have never been higher, and the last two conferences were held in oil-producing countries. So I wonder whether a sort of apathy or even anger about the failure of the COP process will wash back towards the excellent science in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and that you may find in the future that some people that should be your friends are pushing back because they're so disillusioned by the COP process.
I think you mentioned a very, very important point, and one that I think all scientists who are involved in the process have been asking themselves about already for quite a number of years. But of course, the situation is becoming ever more dramatic every year with the increasing damages, increasing losses of life, increasing losses of ecosystems due to the failure of governments to develop appropriate policies. I was in a French national meeting today on the future of the IPCC process. I did not sense a frustration of my, or there's frustration, but not a lack of engagement among my colleagues. I think many of us still maintain that what we do is extremely important, not just for governments to be well advised, but also for situations like elections, where really everyone who gets to elect the future representatives in government can compare what is the action that has been undertaken by governments and what is the what were the recommendations made by the scientists that the governments themselves have approved. So in democratic societies, many of us believe that this role is still very important and needs to be maintained and strengthened perhaps even, but that doesn't mean that we are not frustrated with a lack of progress.
And given jaw-dropping weather events and ocean heat and fast melting poles and many other things, do you think the Intergovernmental Panel reports and predictions have been too conservative?
There are cases where they needed to be corrected because of new evidence. And that, I would say, in the scientific community is a normal process. There have even been cases where some statements in earlier reports have been corrected to, as we found out, that systems were less sensitive to climate change than we initially anticipated. So I would defend the process. I would say we are doing as good as we can in terms of producing summaries of the existing scientific knowledge. And I would argue that it's not inherently conservative. It is true that, like I was mentioning earlier in this conversation about the North Atlantic circulation, is that there's a tendency, if the uncertainty is very high, than to say, well, maybe it will not happen. We could say that sometimes stronger words in terms of maybe it will not happen, but if it happens, it is really, really, really bad. People should perhaps be more willing to make those statements than we have done in the past. But the evidence that's being reported in the chapters and the underlying chapters of the IPCC reports, that evidence is as good as the scientific effort is, which means has limits, but it's neither conservative nor alarmist.
Well, you were early to adopt computers, and scientists already use machine learning to cope with masses of data. Do you think artificial intelligence can help humans protect biodiversity and adapt to climate change? Would you approve of AI using human psychology to achieve these goals?
Well, there are two different questions there. I think the first question is, does artificial intelligence, machine learning, help in the process of the scientific assessment? And I'm convinced that it does. We are in early stages of development, and it is clear that we will see a lot of drawbacks as we see successes. But this is powerful technology that we need to learn and we need to look at critically. And it will, in the end, just like word processors or statistics programs or other things, will be useful. Whether the human psychology will be benefiting or can be influenced it will certainly be influenced in negative ways by artificial intelligence. We already see that the marketing industry is making heavy use of these techniques, and I find that very, very doubtful, and another reason for why really everyone in society needs to understand the basics of this, and we must have a very critical eye on this. I do not think that this actually will help us in any way in terms of better policy making, protecting the planet, simply because this is not about psychology. It is about power. It is about our willingness to limit the influence of some very large fossil fuel companies. And this is a debate which has nothing to do really with artificial intelligence. It has to do more with democracy and with the availability of information to every citizen in every country.
What is climate resilient development? And tell us about the transformation project you are working to develop.
Yes, climate resilient development is a term that has arrived on the scene rather recently. And it essentially implies that if you talk about initiatives to help people and communities to protect themselves against climate hardships, in a way, against difficulties economically or environmentally, that you have to take climate change into account, both in terms of our capacity to adapt to climate change, but also in terms of the need to not contribute to climate change. So in other words, if you look at the agricultural sector and the food industry, then you can, of course, make perhaps more drought-resistant crops, or you can influence irrigation techniques, but you should do this, that this does not actually increase climate resilience. It just increases the capacity of some part of the system to work. If you take a more systemic approach, and if you ask more what do people actually need in order to have a healthy food supply, and what do farmers actually need in order to be able to work under decent living conditions, then this will probably mean changes in technology that are rather different from just getting a more drought-resilient crop. The climate resilient development means taking into account all needs of people and not just needs of some technology to be adapted to different climatic conditions. Yes, and the transformation project, you asked about that. There's a new research program being launched in France this year, which is indeed about transformation. And it is at the same time a new and engaging project in order to study environmental systems and the management of environmental systems in France with the aim of improving livelihoods for people and the conditions for ecosystems. So this is new, you could say, and we intend to establish a new research center for being able to develop these ideas. But it's also standing on the shoulders of a lot of existing research. In France, there are a number of long-term studies ongoing on social ecological conditions in major river catchments, mostly in river catchments, also in some mountain areas, where colleagues for sometimes two decades or more have studied how do people actually influence their environment and how can we change the decision-making, for example, about alpine pastoralism or about the management of agriculture and water quality in the Seine River Basin and other subsystems. These long-term studies, we will try to integrate some of them into a more coherent and more transformation-oriented picture. The deep collaboration between natural scientists, social scientists, and also humanities.
We have been speaking with leading scientist Dr. Wolfgang Kramer. Please find links to all the science and news we talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Wolfgang, thank you for sharing your valuable time with our listeners.
Thanks very much, Alex, for excellent questions.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. Ecoshock.org.